Pittsburgh Sexist National Council of Jewish Women Oral History Project. Marsha Frommerman, Jean Dickman, February 20th, 1975. Side 5, continuing interview with Mrs. Marcus Aaron. Stop.
We had complete respect for each other's integrity.
Who, you
and Mr.
Houston
had complete respect for each other's integrity, and all our arguments were fair and square and above the belt, and neither of us was maneuvering for position.
Was that just you and Mr. Houston, or you and other members of the board were cooperative in the same way?
It was generally cooperative for the majority of the board. When Mr. Houston retired from the presidency, he remained on the board. Mr. William Ray took over, and that was one of the finest periods of leadership that we had for a period of 7 years. Apart from a fine intelligence, Mr. Ray had been involved in many angles of community work and was aware of the needs of the city as a whole. He had the ability to look ahead, anticipate problems, financial and social. He was not a politician, but he understood the political process and what was needed to get results. He spent a great deal of his time in Harrisburg and has been responsible for the formula under which we now operate, which greatly helped the large cities. In addition to which, it was a real pleasure to work with him.
Would you explain for us a little bit about that formula and why that is of benefit to us in the major cities?
Because it makes allowance for what they call increased density and increased poverty. And there is extra reimbursement. It superseded the old formula, which went on the assumption that cities were rich and rural areas were poor, and really ended by giving too much money to rather wealthy suburbia, and ignored the fact that cities were having an increasingly difficult population to educate and a shrinking tax base.
Did this occur toward the end of Mr. Ray's tenure as president of the Pittsburgh School Board?
Oh, it was a battle that went on pretty well through it. I think he accomplished it near the end.
And during what years would this be?
Mr. Ray was president from 59 to 66.
Did Mr. Ray have a good relationship with the other members of the board?
Yes, excellent.
Is there any other highlight of Mr. Ray's tenure that you would like to mention?
Well, he had a great concern for the intellectual quality of the schools and the need for strengthening that. Although he was not unaware of the needs of other parts of the population. But this was just at the time that family life, education, and so on had taken over for a while, and there was, at the time of the swing back, to a concern for the intellectual, and he was thoroughly supportive of that.
I wonder if you would comment for us about how Mr. Ray related to the staff and or the superintendent of schools during his period as president.
Extremely well to the superintendent. I don't know how far down the line he went, but he was very quick. Mr. Ray was a person who was very quick and very sound in his judgment of people. And I know his working with staff. I think, for example, he and the superintendent had at least monthly luncheon meetings, if not more. So there was constant two-way communication.
Would you say that the communication between the superintendent or the staff and the board members was increased communication during Mr. Ray's years?
Probably.
And was that due to an increased awareness on the part of the board members in wanting to improve communication or for some other reason?
I think it was two things. That was part of it. The other part of it was superintendents who, by nature of their personality and ways of operating, wanted that kind of a communication. There was no jealousy between the two.
And
it was a partnership of leadership.
And who was superintendent during those years?
First Acting Gross, and then Dr. Marlin.
Could you comment at this point on the switch from Dr. Gross to Dr. Marlin, how that happened and why?
Well, Dr. Gross had been here 5 years and was doing a superb job. Good communication within the system, had an imaginative approach to a lot of the problems that were facing us, was committed to the upgrading of the intellectual content of the schools. His scholars program was really Dr. Gross's idea. So at the other end was team teaching at the lower end for the poverty schools. He was a brilliant man with a mind like a steel trap, for it so fast. And he was called to New York, and much to our regret and eventually his, to an insoluble situation. As a former New Yorker, I warned him, but he went anyhow. Dr. Marlin was probably the most charismatic superintendent we ever had. Man of great imagination, tremendous vigor, and an extraordinary gift for relationship with his staff. He was always wanted to make sure that the people who did the work got credit. Somebody done a report for him, that person came in to report it to the board. And communication was tremendously important to him, whether it was with the community, whether it was with staff. He met with the principals, was introduced to the principals when he first came to Pittsburgh, before he ever moved here, when he was elected, so that they would know him. And Mr. Ray was president at that time. Mr. Ray also had an extraordinary sense of public relations, something that Mr. Houston thought was utterly unimportant. And I'll never forget Dr. Marlin. At the time that Dr. Marlin resigned, he called a meeting of the principals to tell them personally. And I was coming to a meeting, and I met this stream of principals coming out of the administration building in tears. He had this gift of personal relationships. His secretary adored him. And this went all the way through, with a very few exceptions, people who couldn't quite agree, but there was a tremendous sensitivity to people.
Could we talk for a moment about the selection of Dr. Marlin as our superintendent? Were you part of the whole selection process?
I was a member of the selection committee, which was headed by Mrs. Hazard.
Yes.
Both of the selection of Dr. Marlin and Dr. Close. We were both on that committee. And we had, I think, fairly clear ideas of the type of person for whom we were looking. And especially in those years, for new, fresh ideas. Dr. Dimmick had been an outstanding administrator of good, solid quality. The old school had come up through the system. We felt, no reflection of Dr. Dimmick, whatever, that it was time for some fresh air.
Wasn't Dr. Dimmick the superintendent of schools before Gross?
Gross, that's right. Had been for 13 years. And was a very sound administrator, good communication with the board and with his staff, but he belonged to another era. In both cases of selection of both superintendents, we contacted some of the leading schools of education. Mrs. Hazard had contacts with the Ford Foundation. We went to the American Association of School Administrators. We interviewed members of our own staff. We went to used any contacts we could. We screened Mrs. Hazard and maybe one or two of us. I did a lot of that with her. Reviewed records, selected the ones we thought were worth interviewing, and then, for the most part, interviewed them either where they lived or, for example, Mrs. Hazard would go to a conference where we knew there'd be a bunch of these people, or she went down to the meeting of the American Association of School Superintendents in Atlantic City and holed up very quietly in a motel and made appointments with the people we wanted to see. Then when several members of the committee did this, practically wherever we had contacts, were traveling conveniently, where we could catch these people en route from a meeting home. Then when we had narrowed it, we brought the most likely candidates here for interview by the whole committee for a day or 2 days, quiet and unobtrusive visits occasionally to schools so that they could get the feeling of the Pittsburgh system. And the committee made its selection and recommended to the board and set up an opportunity for the entire board to interview the candidate.
In both Dr. Gross's selection and then in Dr. Marlin's suggestion, how many candidates would you say were brought to Pittsburgh?
Probably not more than about 5 or 6 for interview with the whole board. Although we may have, Mrs. Hazard reviewed the records of perhaps 100 and eliminated a lot, and I reviewed a great many of them, and perhaps another 20 people were interviewed by one member of the committee or another.
Would you say that in the choice of Dr. Gross and Dr. Marlin, the feeling of the board was fairly unanimous?
Oh, yes, it was in a unanimous election in both cases. Uh-huh. Neither one of those men would have come without. Wouldn't have considered it. in fact, we were pretty sure of unanimity before they even came for interview. I mean, that there was inclined to be support. I should add, in those days, it was regarded as the proper way to do this was to go at this in absolute secrecy, that you shouldn't have a leak, that it was rather understood that if news leaked that a man was being considered, he withdrew. Of course, what also happened if his community wanted him to stay badly enough, they'd raise his salary, and that frequently settled it. Unless he had a reason for, real reason for wanting to leave. The other thing we did, of course, was to use any contacts we had in the communities where these people were to get out, get information that we could. For example, one member of the board had a rather negative report on Dr. Gross as to why he had left a certain community, or as to why he had put his name back on the register at Harvard, I believe. And I happen to have had a contact whom I worked at on the Vassar Alumni Board with somebody in that community and got in touch with her and found the reasons that the other man had gotten the negative report were all things that, from our point of view, were positive. These were, he was moving too fast, he wanted to establish a new high school with creative ideas, and the anti-tax people had turned him, had voted against him. Well, these were all things that we thought of were assets. So that we used, I dug up acquaintances with whom I hadn't been in contact in 20 years, but we, all of a sudden, we knew people.
If you were asking so many people, how did you maintain the secrecy?
Well, they were frequently not. It was generally understood that you don't talk about these things. And you asked them, please, not to discuss it. We went so far to maintain secrecy to make different reservations each time. Well, somebody came several times, like Dr. Marlowe. We booked him at the Hilton once and at Webster Hall another time. And today, with this pressure that the community wants a part, it would be very... I think the code has changed. But in those days, it was very important that you should spring this as a surprise on the community once you had complete board support.
You, you mentioned a register at Harvard. Is that where superintendents, do they all register there?
No, it's usually where they took their advanced degrees.
I think what I'm asking is, how do you know which superintendent is available? Do you pirate?
Well, you sometimes do pirate, but usually they register if they are interested. And some of them just keep their files active, keep their records active continuously. But they will communicate with certain agencies and certain places if they are interested in an opening.
All right, I wonder if now we could talk about the switch from Dr. Ray's, Mr. Ray's, presidency of the school board, and who came next?
Well, I came next, inherited a rather fine, sound financial situation momentarily, but I think probably a period of greatest turmoil.
The year was what?
1966. And first place, the unions were stirring, and we had our first strike, and that was for recognition and the right to hold an election. There was legislation on the books at the time which, according to our interpretation, made it illegal for us to bargain with any one group. So we went through assorted fictions till that legislation was accomplished. Dr. Marland was violently opposed to unions. And he had a very strong feeling about the professionalism of teachers. He always referred to the faculty of the Pittsburgh schools. And a few of our board, I think, felt we could not resist it, but the majority did, and for better or worse, we fought it out and eventually agreed to an election that would not be under our sponsorship, because legally we couldn't, but that we would do our talking with the group that won the election, and much to our surprise, the union won it. We thought the other group would, but...
the National Education Association.
Well, the group that was affiliated with them, they called it the PTSEA, but they had very poor leadership, PTSA. And their leadership was quite inadequate. Although it included many of our oldest and most dedicated teachers. And then the other really tough issue during those years was this explosion of the community and its demand for participation in the board meetings. And we held board meetings under police guard, We ran some board meetings through in 10 minutes and got out. Just merely adopted the agenda. Somebody moved that we adopted the agenda of the business committee. We adopted the agenda of the education committee and the personnel reports so that business could go on, and moved out. We met at the on the balcony of conference room A so that we could be separated from the angry mob and could slip out the door if things got too violent.
Would you tell us what years this happened?
Well, this was 68, I think, was the 68, 69 through there. And I don't have it pinpointed, but I could. But the we found out afterwards in the report that a lot of this was deliberately incited by Community Action, Pittsburgh. And I got hold of a report that in which they had made a survey, largely in the Hill District, with their research department, made a survey asking people whether they, what were the things with which they were dissatisfied. And housing, schools, transportation. They came out overwhelmingly satisfied with schools. Far more satisfied with schools than with housing and transportation. And some of their most activist leaders set out to do something about this and to whip them up. Well, we've seen the document, so we know it's true.
It's a CAP document.
Yes. We've seen the research report. And we know the people who were involved. And this was not too evident at the time, but this was whipped up. And it was a little ironic that one government agency, which is what CAP was attacking another and using taxpayers' funds. I mean, they were using their legal, neighborhood legal services, which was designed originally to give a legal service to poor people who couldn't afford it, to give them a way of preventing their gas being shut off if they were late on the rent. We're using this as an agency to bring a lawsuit against us, against the school, for not permitting them to participate in the legislative meetings and to talk on every issue that was brought up. And they would bring in busloads, also with taxpayers' money, of shouting, screaming people. Now, the leader of CAP at that time, Norman Johnson, never spoke at these meetings, but from where I sat, I could see him moving around the back. And he would go up to somebody, a few minutes later that person would speak. He engineered the thing, absolutely. And people in the group weren't aware of that. But this was part of it. Now, it was, of course, a part, in a way, of a movement to get the underprivileged to speak for themselves. But the channels were a little unfortunate. It did result in some good things because it was the open hearing. We finally hit on the open hearing a week before, well, it used to be 2 days, yes, 2 days before the board meeting, before the committee meetings, I beg your pardon. So that before we held our committee meetings, the public had had a chance to express itself, but not participate in the public meeting, which is what other government agencies do. You have, the Congress does not permit the public to participate in congressional debate, neither does City Council, but there is an opportunity for them to appear before committees, and that's what we tried to set up.
So that the public hearing idea began during your tenure as president of the Pittsburgh School Board?
Yes. It was my idea, as a matter of fact. it got to function properly, effectively, under Dr. Kibbe, and he always got credit for that. That and the parent reps.
Occurred when?
That also got started under my
tenure.
But we started it out on a limited basis, tested out the procedure, election and so on, in one neighborhood. And then it got going full blast, again, under Dr. Kibbe, and he got the credit, doesn't bother me a bit. But it was interesting, also a reflection of those times, that when we proceeded to set up the machinery for parent representatives, you wouldn't believe the trouble we had doing it. First PCPE recommended that we do something like that. In the middle of the summer,
Pittsburgh Council on Public Education.
And we asked them, we knew any machinery that we set up would be suspect, that we would be accused of trying to get a group of yes men. So we asked PCPE to proceed, give us the formula for selection. They said, after delaying 3 months, they said they weren't equipped to do it and threw it back to us. We then appointed a committee, a fairly good cross-section of the city, including some rather radical critics.
Now, this is an ad hoc committee, not members of the appointed school board.
This was an ad hoc committee outside the school board. I met with them, but that was all. We asked the League of Women Voters to select the two people, not necessarily their representatives, select two people. We asked the PTA Council to select two people and various other groups I don't recall now. And it took them about, I thought, you know, they'd give it to us in a month. It took them about 4 months because they quibbled indefinitely about who should count the ballots. Could you trust the principal to count the ballots? They thought the principal, I mean, that was the mood of the time. And that is what has worked. I mean, parent reps, it's tended to undermine PTA, but maybe some days, in some ways, PTA is outdated. Not that I wouldn't want this broadcast, but there is a way of cooperation, and they to some extent serve different functions, because PTA includes the teachers. Parent reps do not, and there is a need for such an organization.
Therefore, would you say that the two highlights during your tenure as president would be the parent rep plan as well as the hearings, the beginnings of hearings?
Well, there were certainly some solutions, and facing the fact that we had to live, that the unions were a fact of life and we were going to have to live with them. I think the whole means of working out the channels of public participation and training staff to recognize that it was there. One of the most difficult problems that has come up, I think, is the thing that confronted a lot of our older, dedicated principals to whom a school building was territory in which they had complete authority, and they didn't know what to do with this. They were terrified. Some of them couldn't meet it immediately. But it was a very sad thing to look at a principal, maybe age 60, who had given dedicated service all her life and all of a sudden was up against a force that she couldn't understand. I took it up with Mary Molyneux, director of superintendent for instruction, and suggested they needed help. And within a week, she had set up a seminar for principals in which she not only planned to give them help, but confronted them with the most vigorous of these opponents, so they would learn what they were up against.